wonderful opportunity. The Fields Institute for their hospitality and organization throughout these wonderful days. But most of all to Kathleen for being, of course, Kathleen. As many of you might have imagined in the last few years, working in mathematics for us has been somewhat of a salvation. And the months that we've spent in New York in the last few years has really been the high point of what we've been doing lately. So I'm more than happy to be here. Kathleen, thanks. So as maybe it's fitting that in the last talk that we were actually going to speak about some of Kathleen's more recent results. This is a project which we've been thinking about various aspects for the last few years. And what I want to present today is some progress on a fairly strange question to pose. For equations which have mixed elliptic hyperbolic type, is it possible actually to get any kind of reasonable theory of existence and uniqueness of solutions to this problem, which is typically overdetermined for classical solutions? I'll try to explain why it's an interesting problem to look at and what we've been able to say about it. So the problem that we're looking at is a certain kind of equation of mixed elliptic hyperbolic type. So I apologize, it's written a little low, so maybe I should invite people to come forward. But so the domain that we want to consider is a planar domain. So there are two coordinates, x and y. The equation has a very special form. The second derivative in x is weighted by a function of y alone, which will change sign, and that's responsible for its mixed elliptic hyperbolic character. The domain, you should imagine, should have non-trivial intersection with y positive and y negative, so that the equation is of elliptic hyperbolic type, elliptic upstairs and hyperbolic downstairs. I'll be saying only things about bounded domains today in terms of results, but of course what we're really interested in for the application are going to be unbounded domains, and I'll try to say something at the end if there's time. So typical examples of these kinds of equations are the type change function k. The first instance is k of y equals y. That's the classical equation of Pericomi from the 20s. Soon thereafter, that was generalized to consider for power type nonlinearities. In the 50s, after the connections to transonic flow were made, people tried to just glue together in a brutal way the Laplacian with the wave operator, so the choice of the signum function. Also motivated in part by modeling, in some sense, transonic flows, this Tomatika-Tamada exponential model has some degree of similarity to a real gas. So I'll try to explain a little bit. So as I said, the difficulty in this problem is that you're asking that the condition that U be prescribed is done on the entire boundary. And of course, the presence of hyperbolicity wants to overdetermine that problem for classical solutions. So how can you see that? So here's three classes of problems which have been well studied. So the first one, the AC and the BC are characteristics for the operator. And you prescribe data on the curve in the elliptic region and one of the two characteristics. So you can show a uniqueness theorem of the kind if LU is zero, so zero forcing, and the solution vanishes on the elliptic curve and part of the hyperbolic boundary, if the solution is regular enough, it must vanish everywhere. So of course that suggests the problem is overdetermined for classical solutions, because when you're solving this linear problem, the difference of any two solutions is determined on a subset, a proper subset of the boundary. So its trace on the remaining part of the boundary is already determined. Okay? So that suggests the difficulty of the problem. What you want to do is to relax the space in which you're looking for solutions, large enough so that you can find a solution, and small enough so that you can find a unique solution. And that's proved to be a fairly tricky question to try to solve the problem. I just want to mention that there are several ways of proving these kinds of uniqueness theorems. So the original approach of Pericomi was a sort of constructive, iterative technique. So he sort of solves uniquely the problem. Starting in the 50s, of course, multiplier methods were suggested by Friedrichs, where essentially the ABC method, you take a vector field and a lower order term, multiply the equation, integrate by parts, and try to prove an identity which shows the uniqueness theorem. There's also a beautiful maximum principle, which maybe people don't know about, that hyperbolic equations have very special maximum principles. A paper of Nierenberg, Agmon, and Prater of the 50s, which shows for the Pericomi problem, where the problem is really characteristic data, you have a suitable maximum principle which can be used to show the uniqueness. And the last one I want to mention is a conservation laws proof. So Kathleen also in the 50s showed that if you use the translation and X invariance of the operator, you can associate a conservation law, determine a potential function, study the monotonicity properties of that auxiliary function, and prove the uniqueness theorem. So there are many ways of proving this. The one using energy identities essentially is going to be related to how we're actually going to show existence. So that's the problem. You might ask, why consider such a problem? So, of course, the motivation comes from transonic flow. So I want to review briefly, for this is going to be familiar to everyone, but maybe just to fix some notation. So compressible potential irritational flow in the plane. So we know that that equation is governed by a quasi-linear equation, either for the potential function or this associated analysis equation for the stream function. So the structure of the gas flow equations are such that a hodograph transformation is possible that linearizes it. So we're now finished with the nonlinear part of the talk almost. So we want to linearize this quasi-linear equation, okay? And what comes out is an equation which has this Thrikomi type character. So there is a type change function kappa, k, which depends on sigma. Sigma is a logarithmic rescaling of the flow speed q. And theta is a flow angle. So that strange mixed type equation that was considered for some strange reason by Thrikomi in the 20s actually was associated to transonic flow by Frankel in the 40s. So the equation has exactly that kind of form. For the adiabatic gas, for example, that kappa, that k function, is linear in the origin. So the Thrikomi model is a good model if for some reason the flow is constrained to have speeds which are nearly sonic. Okay, so that's the equation. What are the natural boundary conditions in the hodograph plane? Of course, the hodograph boundary is going to be a free boundary. It's going to be part of the problem if you're thinking about the original flow problem. But what conditions do you want to put on the boundary in the hodograph domain? So in the hodograph domain, if you're thinking about the stream function, then it's natural to consider it to be constant along walls and boundaries and so on. So prescribing a Dirichlet-type condition for the stream function is what you want to do. And of course you don't want to prescribe that condition on a subset, typically, of the boundary. If instead you're thinking about the potential phi, the kind of equation that comes out, the same kind of Thrikomi-like equation comes out, not for the potential function itself, but from a perturbation of the potential. Start from a known flow, say. And that's related to Kathleen's work on non-existence of continuous flows. So looking at the equation for the phi, you use these uniqueness theorems for problems with the data on part of the boundary to show that in general a perturbation isn't going to produce a regular solution. Okay. So with respect to what Chen reminded us about the other day, what we're going to be talking about here is a kind of desire to do the inverse of that problem, something different from that problem. Can you find, for example, a reasonable stream function, a candidate for the stream function in the hodograph plane? Can you try to solve this problem of prescribing the stream function everywhere on the boundary? What kind of solvability theory can you get? So this is a question that Kathleen thought about in the 70s. I guess the last part of the slide just says what I neglected to say is that in the case of the velocity potential, it's a kind of Neumann condition that's natural. So thinking about the stream function, what can you say? Here's another picture I forgot to mention. So maybe it's worthwhile noting that these two classes of problems where you prescribe data everywhere or you prescribe data on a subset of the boundary, both are interesting for transonic flow in different regimes. One, in the case of nozzles and jets, opening up the boundary condition is what's reasonable to consider. Instead, flow about profiles, you should be wanting to prescribe things everywhere. So think about a problem of trying to construct a candidate for the stream function in the hodograph plane. Of course, we're ignoring the very hard problem about whether that hodograph map is well defined or not. But the question is to have some good candidates for solutions. So Kathleen had thought about this problem and had the first breakthrough result in 1970 that said this is not an entirely bad question to ask. You can actually obtain, for at least very special domains, a pretty good solvability theory. You can take a right-hand side, which is essentially L2, there's a weight, and you can find a solution which corresponds to something in an H1 Sobolev space with an appropriate weight, that is a solution in a weak sense to the problem, and it's the only solution in that class. Okay, so that was a pretty, I think, miraculous result. Testimony. And U equals constant on the boundary. Of course, for the Dirichlet case, if one can solve it for U equals zero, you solve it for U equals constant. So I'll explain why she says why I say U equals constant. Actually, she looked not at the second order equation directly. It was reduction to a first order system. So in fact, her theorem is more general than that. So there's a class of first order systems which would include those which descends to a second order equation with the Dirichlet condition of phi equals constant on the boundary.
You say that there's a weight. Does that weight somehow vanish on the...
Alright, the weight is a finely constructed object using some complex function theory and Kathleen's magic, which essentially was chosen to either vanish or blow up at these two parabolic boundary points. So in some sense, it's a very finely constructed object, not simple to write down its expression, with some asymptotic information, let's say, about what a possible singularity might look like. So of course, in that result, that opens up the question as to whether somehow this is a very special situation or not. And one should say in the result, what we'd like to do in this project is then to say, all right, can you generalize essentially some of the elements in that theorem? So she used the type change function, just k of y equals y. So one would like to get at more general type change functions k. One would like to get, of course, at more general domains, in fact, domains which should be somehow candidates for Hodegraaff images. And we'd like to work directly on the second order equation. So that, I think, is essentially for two basic reasons. One is, well, Daniela comes from variational methods. So there is a very nice functional associated with this problem because it has divergence form. And there's a very nice candidate for the weighted Sobolev space in which to work, that which makes that Dirichlet form well-defined. So since the idea of what is the right space to find the solution, how to choose a weighted situation which is large enough to allow solutions but small enough to guarantee existence, we sort of suggested to push along the line of this structure. The second reason, I think, for considering directly on the second order equation is if any of you have ever, most of you probably have, looked at the papers of Friedrichs on positive symmetric systems and these multiplier methods and their matrices, and they would be 2x2 matrices in this two-dimensional case, and you essentially have two free parameters that correspond to a vector field. Okay? If you work instead directly on the second order PD, there's a third degree of freedom, which comes essentially a coefficient of U. And it'll be important to exploit that third degree of freedom in some sense to relax some of these conditions. The operator is formally self-adjoint, and that means that obtaining estimates, for example, when you're working, say, on the operator and working on its adjoint, they'll be the same. So, what kind of weak solutions are we finding? We're finding weak solutions which, I suppose, having said that there's a variational structure, one always already knows what sense of the solution is going to be. So we'll look for solutions in this weighted Sobolev space where k is weighting the x derivative. And we'll think about the sort of the standard closure of just the Dirichlet integral, the norm, throwing away the L2 part, which we'll be able to do if we have a Poincaré-type inequality. And let's say, in general, there will be a Poincaré-type inequality, at least for the domains which are reasonable for these transonic flow problems. So we can bound the L2 norm in terms of this weighted H1 norm. So a weak solution is just going to be something where you throw half of the derivatives on the test function, and the test function space is the same space in which you're looking for a solution. So H1 naught, the closure of, say, smooth functions with respect to that norm. It's equivalent to say that you can find some good approximating sequences. So that would be functions which approximate in the H1, weighted H1 naught norm. and whose image under L is compatible with its continuity properties. So of course there's an extension of the operator from H1 naught into its dual. And so that's the sense in which you have approximating solutions. So H minus 1, of course, is just the dual, and we use the standard negative norm in the sense of lax. So again, one parenthetical comment, this idea of a weak solution isn't quite what often gets called a strong solution in the sense of Friedrich's, where you might be asking not only H minus 1 convergence of the image, but L2 convergence. So we have a slightly weaker notion of solution than a strong solution. And that remains a difficult question even for these open boundary value problems. So that's the sense of the solution. The theorem that we're able to prove under various situations is, so for a reasonable type change function K and for large classes of domains omega, given F in a weighted L2 space, there is a unique solution in this H1 not weighted. So the weight is just the type change function, the minus 1 times Lebesgue measure. So of course that makes it a subspace. That's not a problem for the transonic flow applications, because if you remember, the equation is really a homogeneous equation. There is no source term. So where's the source term coming from? The idea would be looking at the image of the point at infinity, resolve in some sense the character there, and then push that resolution into a forcing function on the right-hand side. So in general, the right-hand sides are going to be, say, compactly supported in the elliptic region. So that it's a technical assumption for our method, but it's not a technical assumption which worries us for the application. Okay, so that's what the theorem looks like. Of course, I'll specify what it means to be suitable both for the type change function and for the domain. But I should mention, essentially, how are we going to prove such a theorem? It's based on an appropriate energy estimate. So the key estimate is to say we want to be able to find a constant, which is going to depend on the domain and the type change function, for which we can bound the L2 norm of U, weighted by K, in terms of the H minus 1 norm of the action of L. Okay? So if you can establish such an estimate, then just standard Hahn-Banach plus Riesz representation theorem gives you what kind of result. For every right-hand side in the dual to the L2 weighted space, there is a unique solution in H1 naught. Okay? So we're doing an a priori estimate on the scale of regularity of controlling the L2 norm of U by the H minus 1 norm. Okay? So if one can establish such an estimate, then one has the solution. I should underline again that L as agrees with its formal transpose. So we have this L estimate both for L and its adjoint. Okay. Okay, so existence and uniqueness follow from the estimate. And so the question is how to obtain such an estimate. So our approach is almost always, I'd say always, a global approach. So we're going to get a global estimate on the whole domain of that kind. It's going to be an energy estimate using a multiplier method. But the multiplier is not going to be the standard ABC of using a differential operator applied to the test function integrated against the operator. It's going to be an integral operator. So the idea is going to be to first, so the A's, the B's, and the C's are the objects, the coefficients to choose for the multiplier. And the test function to be integrated against LU is not going to be M, that differential operator applied to U. In fact, it's going to be solving V from the equation MV equals U. Okay? And what we'll want is to treat the Dirichlet problem, we're going to want a geometry that's reasonable so that the Dirichlet condition imposed everywhere, okay, is going to be felt by that test function V. So we're going to be actually asking to solve a strange first-order problem, kind of typically the thing one sees in textbooks, one doesn't consider, where the entire flow, there's essentially a sink. And we want to put a point of sink on the boundary. Okay, so that's what we'd like to do. So what are reasonable classes of type change functions? So we can obtain results for functions which are of power type. So in particular, the Perigomi equation and all powers of that. remember, for the transonic flow, of course, only Y was reasonable, and that only for nearly sonic speeds. So Kathleen's never been particularly a fan of our insistence on this model. We've invested a lot in this model and learned a lot from this model. So maybe I'll just give two words of publicity for it. So why is it a nice model? It's a nice model because it's got a very rich geometric structure underneath. It's got a very large group of symmetries, which are all conformal transformations with respect to certain underlying mixed Riemannian-Lorentzian metrics. So we learned a lot from this, but we were appropriately, you know, boxed about the ears by Kathleen to not be happy with a model which was sort of mathematically interesting and we liked. The question is always to try to move to the real problem. So the results have improved dramatically under that gentle pressure, let's say. Okay, so here's an example of a general class of type change functions, which includes, say, the adiabatic gas law. Okay, so it's a long list of assumptions, but they are all satisfied, at least by the model. So so a certain amount of regularity, C2, that YKY should be for Y different from zero. That's just the type change condition. Strictly increasing with positive derivative. There's an auxiliary function that plays an important role, which is K divided by K prime, the derivative of that. That's not a strange object, at least it's not an unfamiliar object. The condition of Frankel posed on his solvability theorem involves essentially also that function. So it's a classical object. We ask only that its value of that function is also non-negative in the origin. And for a certain part of the results, to extend some of our results, we're also going to make use of some concavity in K for Y negative. Okay. So that class... Okay, so, right, so of course you start with the pressure density relation, right? And then using Bernoulli, you can express it in terms of the speed. And then we've logarithmically rescaled the speed.
So in principle, it's not contradiction even with its physical meaning if you would do a correction for very small speeds.
Okay, so I'll try to explain. Maybe it'll be clear if I explain, and if not, then we'll come back. Okay, so my claim is that if you take exactly the type change function that comes out of the hodograph and you start from the adiabatic gas law in compressible potential flow, you will get a function which has this as its qualitative graph. Okay, it is strictly increasing. It's everywhere concave, in fact. The only thing that it doesn't satisfy is that monotonicity condition on the auxiliary function mu. It doesn't satisfy it everywhere. It satisfies it for all y positive, which would be the subsonic region, and it satisfies it in the supersonic region up to a certain point. Okay, so of course there's a minimum allowed, there's a maximum flow speed allowed in order to keep the pressure positive, and so that allowable value for us is going to be somewhere in between the sonic speed and the maximum flow speed. So if I did the correct calculation correctly, it should be Mach number square root of 5, more or less. So.
Gamma equals 1 case.
Oh, gamma equals 1 case? I didn't check. So for reference values, I chose 1.4. But so in fact, it works for any gamma bigger than 1 for sure, and I'm not sure gamma equals 1. I'll have to get back to you. Okay, so those are two classes of type change functions which we can treat. So what kinds of domains can we treat? So the first kind of domain is a first class of domains which uses a suitable notion of being star-shaped. And this sort of grew out of our experience with these invariances for those power-type nonlinearities. These power-type nonlinearities have a dilation invariance. And of course, if you have a dilation invariance, that means that the integral identities that you're writing in, if they're not a conservation law, they're going to have some of the simplest expressions. That is essentially where this came from. So you have the key estimate that I said, the a priori estimate that I said, and hence then the existence and uniqueness theorem. If you have a domain which is piecewise C1, probably Lipschitz would be enough, just divergence theorem there. I want the domain to be V star-shaped. So I need to fix a vector field, V, which is calibrated to the type change function K in an appropriate way. So I establish a geometric notion attached to the class of K. So star-shaped means what you'd think it means. Take a point on the boundary. I want the flow under the vector field to be always inside the domain. The vector fields that we're going to choose are always going to have the property of being globally Lipschitz, so I don't have any existence and uniqueness problems for the vector field problem. And they're always going to have a unique singular point, a unique vanishing point, which I'm going to put on the boundary. Okay. The problem, of course, is invariant in translations in X, so we'll always normalize putting the origin at point B. Okay. So the parabolic boundary point, the where the degeneracy is with maximum X coordinate always in the origin. So for the power type change functions, it turns out that if you start with the infinitesimal generator of the dilation of variance upstairs and slightly fudge it downstairs, that turns out to be the right notion of star shape, a right notion of star shapeness. If you choose the general class and you use just a linear flow upstairs with the right kind of slope, and the downstairs, you see that k over k prime. That's where the assumptions on that mu function are going to come from. Who's k over k prime? In the power type case, it's exactly y, or constant times y. So it was the guess in some sense about how to generalize the dilation invariance. So we can choose a domain as long as it's star-shaped with respect to the appropriate vector field calibrated to the type change function. So the flow lines for the, in the power case always arrive perpendicularly at the x-axis. And that's bad for the transonic flow applications because you want monotonicity of the flow speed with respect to the flow angle. So when we first found this result, we were happy, and then when we thought more about the local geometry, we were less happy. But so as a start, these star-shaped domains are all right. In the general case, you can choose parameters for the linear flow upstairs and actually have a number of different kinds of the geometry, but in the hyperbolic region you always have this orthogonal crossing. Okay, so these are somehow limitations of this first class of domains. Okay, and of course the star-shaped assumption in the elliptic domain is something that one really doesn't want at all. So I'll try to be brief. I just wanted to give you a flavor in some sense of what does the proof of the key estimate look like? What are the ingredients? And in some sense, where the assumptions we've made come into play. So I'll remind you that what we'd like to do to establish the existence and uniqueness, we just need this a priori estimate, L2 control in terms of H minus 1 control. So the first step is to solve this auxiliary Cauchy problem for a first order differential operator M, where I use the B and the C, the coefficients of that vector field that defines the notion of being star-shaped. So I use star-shaped just to say that the problem is well posed. I can consider the problem. Choosing the coefficient A, which multiplies the V in the equation, to be negative guarantees that once the following a flow line, once you leave the support of the test function U, you have exponential decay along the flow lines. And so in some sense that singular point doesn't give you a singularity in the solution of the auxiliary function V. So that's the point at which the reduction, say, to the using the second order equation, instead of the system, we have that parameter and we're using that degree of freedom there. Okay, so I say that the function that we're constructing V from this auxiliary Cauchy problem is an element of the space in which we're looking for the solution. So you estimate from below V, a scalar product with LU. Okay. Integrate by parts, and what do you get? You get essentially a quadratic form in the gradient of V plus some boundary integrals. The boundary integrals are zero because of the boundary conditions, essentially. And you can explicitly estimate from below the coefficient. So here we're using, say, the algebra of the multipliers in order to have a positive form when we're considering the integration of L against LU against V. So in that estimate, of course, it's VLMV. So it's like an a priori estimate for a third order operator, LM. Okay. So we have an explicit expression for what that lower bound is, and that's going to be important for the generalizations. Notice that in the power type case, the coefficient is 1. It doesn't see anything about the size of the domain or anything. And in the case, the general case that includes the adiabatic law, it's just that parameter C naught, which we're choosing for the sort of the tilt of the flow upstairs, which is fixed and doesn't see anything about the domain, and the value of that mu function in the origin. So it's uniform with respect to whatever star-shaped domain you have. Okay. The upper bound is just generalized Schwartz inequality. And the last element that you need is when you're trying to rewrite the estimate in terms of U, you need essentially a continuity estimate for the differential operator M. And it turns out in order to bound in terms, so we're looking for a solution in H1 naught with the weight K, we're forced to put in a weight on the L2 norm in order to have that continuity estimate. So it's technical, the reason why the right-hand side is getting weighted in that way. Okay. A different choice of norm might mean we could eliminate the restriction on that. Okay. The constant in that continuity estimate depends on, well, A, the L infinity norm of A, which is a constant. The width of the domain for the transonic flow applications is going to be the X is corresponding to the flow angle, and that's always going to be bounded by a constant. The L infinity norm of K, which is going to be bounded on a domain. The L infinity norm of C, the auxiliary function that we're choosing, and a Poincaré constant, which is essentially has monotonicity properties with respect to the size of the domain. Okay. So we combine all of that and we obtain the a priori estimate, which is looking pretty uniform. Okay. So recall we had these two defects in the star-shaped result. One was orthogonal crossing, which was needed in the hyperbolic boundary at least, and a lot of restrictions on the elliptic boundary geometry. So how to eliminate the orthogonal crossing problem? So what we noticed was, if you take from a domain which is sort of crossing transversely, which is the geometry we'd like, and you just back up a little bit and drop a characteristic, okay, the resulting domain is star-shaped with respect to the flow translated to have it sink in this point. Okay, so that's an admissible domain. You have the estimate. You have a solution on that domain with a notch cut out. The estimate is uniform in epsilon because it doesn't depend on epsilon. So essentially, you can pass to a limit. Okay. So we trace that problem out by a limiting construction. So the base of the slide is just an outline of what I had said there. Essentially, the estimate's independent. We can pass to a limit. So that leaves us with the problem of all of the elliptic boundary geometry. And there is something that we've suffered a long time, maybe suffered too much. I mean, I think a lot of approaches we've taken, I think I underestimated the difficulty of this problem. I think the idea that somehow the elliptic boundary geometry shouldn't be seen. So that leads you to all kinds of proofs that you think are proofs until you check them more carefully. And it seems to be a difficult thing to remove, technically difficult thing to remove this elliptic boundary geometry. Essentially, what the main problem we found was that these estimates, at least doing it directly on the level of the L2 H minus 1 estimate, it doesn't, at least we're not able to localize somehow the procedures. So we tried all kinds of cutoff procedures and a lot of them failed. So finally, we've returned to a global approach again. So the domain, if it were star-shaped, would be all right. So we construct a sort of star-shaped hull. So start from a domain which isn't star-shaped. So I take all of its boundary points, I put in the all of its trajectories, and I have a new domain which encloses the original domain. I can perform the original estimate. So I take the test function U supported in the original domain. I extend it by zero, and I solve the Cauchy problem on the bigger domain. What I have is my auxiliary function vanishes on a subset of the original boundary. What would be the part in purple minus these black bits, which I'm calling perhaps not right, the non-star-shaped parts. What I mean by non-star-shaped would be the part of the boundary which doesn't agree with the boundary of the hull. So you find that test function, which is vanishing on a subset of the boundary. Using that estimate that comes out of that construction, you can prove an estimate for functions which vanish on the big subset of the boundary where it was star-shaped. That buys you a solution, a weak solution, which is vanishing on not all of the boundary, but a part of the boundary. We've rigged it so that it's always vanishing on all of the hyperbolic boundary and at least the first part of the elliptic boundary. And then you can exploit the isomorphism between H1-naught and H-1 under L, restricted to the elliptic region. And using that fact, we claim that you can show that U actually must vanish on the rest of the boundary. Okay, so that's essentially the idea. So taking a suitable convex hull under the star-shaped flow and solve the problem which is vanishing on all the hyperbolic boundary plus a little bit of the elliptic boundary. So that's the idea of the proof. In order to make it work, the only thing that we need to assume about the domain is some regularity. So the piecewise C1 is B4. We assume that the domain is star-shaped at least up to some height delta. Delta can be as small as you like. So some of the elliptic region is still star-shaped. Okay. Then we need another little bit of the domain to be able to be written essentially as a graph, as a function. So the hyperbolic boundary needs to be a graph, y as a function of x, convex in the y direction. Again, for the flow applications, that's a reasonable thing. Why do we need that convexity assumption? We need that convexity assumption in y because when we finish up the estimate for using the part where it's bounding that the auxiliary operator m, there was need for a Poincaré inequality. But v now doesn't vanish on the entire boundary, it vanishes on a subset of the boundary. So essentially what we're, you can integrate in y with using the convexity and you've got some positive measure left over and standard real analysis techniques finishes the thing. So that's what I wanted to say.
Are you saying now that you can solve the thing, you just prescribe U0 a part of that elliptic boundary?
No, what I'm saying is you can solve uniquely in the sense of the theorem for a unique solution, putting 0 everywhere on the original domain, so that would be the original, the purple part, okay? All you need for the original domain is convexity in the y direction up to some height delta star. So some convexity in the y direction. Star-shapedness up to height delta. Okay, so there's, you have the star-shaped assumption on the hyperbolic region plus a little bit of the elliptic region. And slightly less of that domain needs to be convex in the y direction. Plus local Lipschitz boundary.
You said something, if you assume vanishing on just part of that elliptic boundary, it automatically vanishes.